Hey, what's happening? Thanks for tuning into another episode of Let There Be Talk. It is, what is today? November 7th, a Monday. One or two days? When are we voting? Got to get out there and vote, man. It's coming up. I vote for Elko and Harley. That's who I vote for, my sponsor, man. These guys are the number one motorcycle dealer in America. For me, they are. I love them, and you're going to love them, too. Go down there and buy yourself a motorcycle or get yourself a bike serviced or maybe some helmets, whatever you need. Check them out, man. El Cajon Harley right now. What do they got going? They got a tire sale. They will not be beat on tires. You need new tires, man. The rain season's coming up. Yeah, the rain season. It hasn't rained in LA in 20 years. It rains for like 5 minutes a year. That's what I love when people go, "You only own a motorcycle? What do you do when it rains?" It's like, let me know when it rains. Yeah, man. Get yourself a Harley Davidson. They got all kinds of selection down there. They got new and used. They can get you financed. I'm loving the new Milwaukee 8 motor. My boy Greg Riley and I have been talking about it nonstop. Also, Greg and I are about to go see some Temple of the Dog. I'll get into that in a minute. Get yourself a Harley Davidson, El Cajon Harley. Follow him on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Show some love to him, man. Let him know that this sponsorship is working. El Cajon Harley. Love him. All right, yeah, here it is. Another episode of Let There Be Talk, number 302. Can you guys believe it? 302 episodes of Let There Be Talk. If you want to donate to the podcast, I don't say it much, but it does help. Go to patreon.com/DeanDelRay and throw some nickels at the podcast if you want. Helps out. Thinking about doing a little upgrade on some gear here. Always trying to keep the podcast sounding good and fresh for you guys. Anyway, if you want to donate, it's really easy. Patreon.com/DeanDelRay. What do I got going on today? I'm just kind of getting up. I'm going to go see the Iggy Pop documentary. I don't even know what it's called. I can't remember. I do know, but I'm too lazy to look it up. But I'm going to go see that today. Beautiful day here in LA. It's just going to be 90 all of November. I can't believe it. There's just no winter anymore. There is no winter. It's insane. Let's see. What is it right now? It's 72 at 10 a.m. in the morning. 72 degrees. You got to love it. It's going to be fucking cooking all week. Actually, it's just going to be beautiful. It's going to be like 80 all week. Gotta love that. Let me see. I was talking about Temple of the Dog earlier. I cannot fucking believe it. I'm so fired up to see him. I'm about 2 weeks away. And I saw the set list from the first night a couple nights ago. I think it was in Philly. I mean, this set list made my fucking head fall off. This is the kind of shit that makes you just realize why all the people involved with Soundgarden and Mother Love Bone and Pearl Jam, that whole crew. This is a little one of the reasons why they have been around fucking 25 years or whatever it's been. Because they fucking care, man. I mean, they could easily just go out and do like the Temple of the Dog record, a couple Love Bone songs and be out of there. Like a 13, 14 song set, people would be like, "That was great." But no, they do 23 fucking songs. And some of the songs just made my jaw fall to the ground. Like they did Achilles Last Stand by Zeppelin, and you can see it on YouTube. just crushing it. They did Baby Lemonade by Syd Barrett. I can't believe how... This is what I love about these guys. Their music taste, it ranges all over the board. They go from Syd Barrett to a Cure cover, Fascination Street, which is my favorite Cure song, into War Pigs. I mean, this is their encore, just nodding to the Idols. A nod to the Idols, man. It's just insane. And then, of course, I had no idea that they were going to do so much Mother Love Bone. What a fucking surprise. I love it. They did Stardog Champion, Stargazer, Heartshine, Holy Roller, Like a Holy Roller. God, man, I love these guys. I love the music they've made. I just got the Mother Love Bone vinyl box set. You get the original record, and then you get the EP, the Shine EP. And then it comes with this incredible kind of like a gift little box thing. I don't even know how to... It's like an envelope full of shit that is just next level. A couple of their first 8x10 promo shots are in there, Love Bone. So good to see, man. You see Jeff in that early fucking just grunge gear. I love that look, man. It's kind of like Street Gorilla meets 24/7 Partier. It's kind of like shorts, boots, maybe some thermals under it with some kind of fucking weird army jacket or something. It's the perfect outfit just to drink until you pass out somewhere on the floor and then wake up and keep rolling. That's the look, man. You know, Street Gorilla, Urban Street Gorilla, not grunge. Anyway, it comes with a couple cool promo photos, and then it comes with the badass poster. They reprinted a Rocket fanzine, like a mag that was out in Seattle, with the full interview with Andrew Wood. They re-fucking print this thing. And then they, a couple stickers, a ticket to one of their shows back in the day. It's fucking next level, man. Anyway, well worth the money. I mean, because just to get the Love Bone record's going to cost you like $100 on eBay. And you can get this whole thing, I think, for like $100. So it was just, it's so, so killer. I've been listening to it all weekend. And, yeah. So, Temple of the Dog, if you didn't get a ticket, man, I suggest that you comb Craigslist and go see this. New York City's coming up, Madison Square Garden. I think the most epic two nights will be at the end of the tour. They're only doing, I think, 12 dates. End of the tour will be at Seattle, and that would be just insane to see him there, man. What else going on? We had a horrible weekend over here, man. Just one of the worst things, worst thing to wake up to whenever a rock star dies, not even a rock star, but somebody that you just look up to in the music world. And it's happening more and more, of course, as I get older, my heroes are leaving. And that happened on, I believe it was Saturday. I wake up, I see a post from Rich on Instagram, rest in peace, Eddie Harsh. I just couldn't believe it. 59 years old. Eddie, you know, he was just about to do these shows with Rich and Mark and everybody, and I was so fired up to go see this. And also just having Rich on the podcast recently where he was talking about how Ed was fired up to play again, and he had come out to Woodstock, and Mark talking about how they roomed together in Danko's room. And it was just, it's just such a bummer, man. Eddie was really the guy, and I talk about this all the time, was really the guy that opened my eyes to having keyboards in a band. Eddie made it cool to me to have keyboards. Growing up, I was always like, keyboards? No, because it was just kind of that, you know, 80s synth stuff, kind of like Jefferson Starship, We Built This City, you know, dee, dee, dee. Even Jump, I never liked that synth stuff. It was just funny coming from me who absolutely worships Kraftwerk, but that's different. That's their sound, you know? And I never really realized how big a part keyboards were to every band I love. Excuse me. Zeppelin, of course, all that early stuff, all that 70s rock, you know, Deep Purple. Everybody had a B3, a Fender Rhodes, a Wurlitzer, a clavinet. I mean, come on, Stevie Wonder. And I realized I was just, for a small period of time in the 80s, was just a buffoon. You know, like, oh, I'm an idiot. Like, oh, no keyboards. But it was just the wrong keyboards. It's like when you go eat sushi. If you have bad sushi the first time, you're like, ew, gross. Not until you have good sushi do you want go, I want sushi in my band on stage right. You know? But Ed, I remember, you know, if you just sit there and listen to that sometimes Salvation, you get into that Black Crowes whole sound of B3 and Wurlitzer, man. I love fucking Wurlitzer. All the stuff Eddie played Under a Mountain, man, it starts up just that, you know, that sound. And of course Descending. Just his masterpiece there in the Black Crowes world. It was strange later on seeing Black Crowes without Mark Ford and Eddie. It always felt kind of weird to me. But I am a super fan, and of course I keep going, but I always missed a man over there. They had a couple other, or I don't know, maybe one keyboard or two. I couldn't even tell you who those keyboard players were, because the sound was there, but the vibe and the feel wasn't. So I never took interest. I'm sure the guy's great, and it's probably, I'm going to get emails like, oh, that guy's such and such. Cool. But he wasn't Eddie, man. Eddie is absolutely a guy you want in your band when you see the look, the vibe, you know what I mean? That guy was rock and roll. He was, to me, he was just like Cliff Burton's dad. Him and Cliff Burton, or brothers, whatever, man. They could have been like right there, their look, just the long hair, just rock and roll, cigarette hanging out of his mouth, just like up there. It looked like he was always saying far out. Whenever I looked at Eddie, I thought he would just be like, far out, man. Anyway, man, such a bummer, but we got the records, and I played them throughout the weekend and enjoyed them. Anyway, long live Eddie. Let's get into the episode here. Let's get into it, man. Got some good stuff today. I talk about this band once in a while, Buck Cherry. You guys know him, I'm sure. If you're a fan of this podcast, you know who Buck Cherry is. I remember, and I talked to my guest, Keith Nelson, today. I talked to him about when I first heard about Buck Cherry. It was in the late 90s, and it was kind of a changer for me. That band was one of the reasons I moved to LA, because I realized at the time San Francisco was completely dead. And am I going to sit here and just participate in my own funeral? Is that what I'm going to do? You know, I was 35 or something, maybe 34. And San Francisco was done. The dot-com, the first wave of bullshit, greed, real estate, and everything blew through town with the dot-com. And all the clubs closed when that shit ended. Dot-com being the all these startups back in the 90s in San Francisco. These companies came in and they gave all these people these, invisible money. I own 4,000... shares in Scooby-Doo Wi-Fi. And, you know, I'm a millionaire. And everybody thought they were millionaires. And then when these places all closed, they had no money and the town was fucking tumbleweeds. Paradise Lounge was gone. DNA Lounge was gone. Night Break was gone. I-Beam was gone. The Stone was gone. Of course, that was gone early on. But the only things that really survived it were Bottom of the Hill and Slim's. And, you know, we're talking about when you play music for a living and there's a thriving rock and roll scene just 5 years before in San Fran, and then it's just fucking gone. All kinds of things took out San Francisco. It was the cover bands. It was the dot-com. It was people getting older that were living in San Francisco weren't going out, and the young people were into raves. They were going out, but they were raving. So it was a perfect storm, and it was time for me to fucking move. I remember it specifically. I was playing the Viper Room, the Dean Del Rey band, playing the Viper Room. It was sold out. I looked around. I was like, look at this fucking town. This town still rocks. I'm out of here. And the next day, I rented a car, drove around town, looked for an apartment for about a week, packed my bags, and never looked back. I miss San Francisco. People ask me that all the time. You miss San Francisco? Of course I do. It's who I am, man. That city, when I'm there, I absolutely love it. I love the food. I love my friends that I've got friends there my entire life that when I see, we pick up exactly where we left off and we laugh and it makes me feel good. I don't miss what San Francisco is now, which I don't have much in common with. It's a techie world, of course, everybody knows, and there's not much rock and roll in there. Not much art, to say the least. Thank God the comedy clubs are still there because I think people need to laugh when they're miserable paying $5,000 for a one-bedroom apartment. Who wouldn't need to laugh for that? So my point is, Buck Cherry in the late 90s was making some noise on the Sunset Strip, and they were also making noise to anybody that had rock and roll in their blood. It was like, oh, yeah. And this is right before Strokes, Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, and all that, which I always call the second wave of rock. Not really the second wave, but I mean, it was like a rebirth in leather jackets and guitars. But right before that, you had a band called Buck Cherry, and they had Lit Up and For the Movies on their first record. And I was like, ah, this is a great band. And they had a front man that was tattooed head to toe and guitars that were slung low and played through Marshalls. And it looked familiar, but it sounded fresh, and I was on board. Loved it. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons, probably one of the main reasons I moved to L.A., because I saw, holy shit, if these guys can get a record deal in their, I don't know what they were, they're probably in their 30s at the time, and so was I. I was thinking, shit, anything's possible. And I wasn't coming down here like, I'm going to get a record deal. But at least I knew if I came down here, I could play rock music in front of people. And it changed my life. I moved here, and my whole life is completely different from a 300-mile move. My life right now is so different that I can't believe. I'm a comedian now. It's insane. But look at the road I took to get here, and it has to do a lot with LA. Anyway, this guy's a great man. I loved him. He's very honest. He plays the shit out of guitar. He loves leather jackets like myself and motorcycles. We have so much in common that I'm looking forward to having a part two with him on. Enjoy this, and one last thing before I bring him on, please leave a review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It helps. I'm at like 700, and I think, let's see where I'm at. I'm at like 738 or something. I'm trying to reach 1,000 reviews. I've got a zillion listeners. It's pretty fucking easy. Just go iTunes, click, love this podcast, and move on. That's how easy it is. If just half of you did it, I would have fucking 50,000 reviews. Can you imagine a podcast with 50,000 reviews? It would be number one every week. That's how it works, man. That's how it works. You guys are in charge. Click and review, and this thing gets bigger and bigger. You leave that review, and have a great week. Put on some Black Crowes, and then when you're done with that, put on some Buck Cherry. It's funny talking Black Crowes because Keith loves Black Crowes. Here he is right now. Candles are lit. Oh, one last thing. I'm in Sacramento this week, right? Yeah, come see me in Sacramento. Punchline. Lucas Hurl and myself coming. I'll be headlining all this week, 10, 11, 12 at the Punchline. Get your tickets. Come see me. And then New York City, I'll be there 17 through 20. And then San Francisco Punchline, December 15th, 16th, 17th. See you in Sacramento this week. Candles lit! All right, here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. A great guest today. Introduce yourself, my man.
My name is Keith Nelson. I make some racket in Buck Cherry.
Yeah, you do. Guitar in
Buck
Cherry.
What's up, dude? What's up?
Good, man. It's so funny. Like, we met years ago. But like somehow somebody turned me on to you, like you wanted to do a country record or something when I first moved here, and I went to your house in like Studio City or something.
Yeah, you know, I think Buck Cherry was on a hiatus then.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of out, you know, I just wanted to be a guitar player in a band and not have to worry about booking the shows, making the t-shirts, and I was dabbling in a bunch of stuff.
I think it was right before you guys kind of fucked around with Velvet Revolver, because that's why I think you abandoned it. You were like,
I think it was actually right after that.
Oh, was it? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because playing in that situation was kind of the thing that brought it to a hiatus.
Yeah, okay. I got you. We're jumping way ahead, but
we are.
but it's always an interesting thing to me because I auditioned for that and had Duff on, and we talked quite a bit about it, and I had completely forgot that the early incarnation was you and Josh in that band.
You know, it started out pretty pretty innocently, you know. I'm going to leave a lot of detail out, but basically what happened is that we did a benefit for Randy Castillo.
Right.
And Slash had called me up and said, you and Josh want to do this. We'll do a couple of Gun songs. We'll do a couple of your songs if you want. We'll just do this benefit. It'll be fun. So we went and rehearsed a few days. Everyone got along great. And we did it. And like at sound check that day, Slash says, hey man, Steven wants to come down. And I'm like, Steven who? And he's like, Tyler. I'm like, oh shit.
Wow. like the fucking president.
And he goes, what song do you think we should do? And I said, well, I know them all because that's kind of how I learned to play the guitar. So yeah. Aerosmith records. But I just thought the easiest thing to do would be play Mama Ken, because they did it on
Chorus, on the Lies.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the EP.
And we just kind of ran through it at soundcheck, and you know, 7 hours later, Steven jumped up with us. It was a pretty awesome night.
Yeah.
You know, the buzz was huge. And then after that, it was just kind of like...
what year was that?
Geez, what year was that? 2002?
Oh, 2002. Yeah. That's like right around when I moved here. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it quickly became, I think, because Duff and I rode together or were in the car together. He picked me up, and on the way home, I said, we should make that a band, dude. That was fucking rad.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, let's talk to Slash and see what he says. And so that commenced a few months of us all being together 5 days a week, writing. And
over at Mates.
And jamming. We started at Mates, but then we actually graduated to my spot that I had because it was like a monthly lockout thing. And it was much less expensive. So we went over there for a while, and I recorded every rehearsal.
Yeah?
Multi-track.
Wow.
And so they all exist.
Wow.
And they never leaked because I'm not that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Original tunes?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like anything that made it on the record later?
Well, we had Crazy Bitch before that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, so we had written that. The Buck Cherry story up to that point was we had a couple of guys quit, and Josh and I were kind of standing there holding the bag and holding the record deal. And workaholics, you know, crazy, insane, sober guys that don't know how to do anything but drink coffee and work.
Right.
And we were writing songs, man. So we wrote Crazy Bitch, demoed it. I played all the instruments on it. Dean Butterworth, who plays with everybody, was a friend of ours. He played drums on it. We made a demo. And about 14, 16 other songs that we were thinking would be the third Buck Cherry record. We put a pause on that to go play this thing. That turned into this, what we thought was going to be a band. So we took like the best couple ideas.
Right.
And brought them to the band. So, you know, we've got a few things. Let's just kick them around. Crazy Bitch was one of them. I have a version of that song with us playing that with Matt Duff and Slash.
Wow. That's that's pretty cool.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm very respectful to everybody.
Yeah, and, of course.
At least I try to be. Yeah. And so the idea of like that shit leaking, that's not going to happen for me. And I believe I have the only, I think they probably have a copy and I have the only copy.
Yeah. Now, why does it disintegrate? Do you just figure the chemistry wasn't there? It was just you ran its course?
It was probably a chemistry thing.
Yeah.
You know?
It's tough to get lightning in the bottle again. I mean, when you're coming out of GNR, and that's kind of like their first dabble back into like, let's play with guys. They got to always in their mind be comparing it to the first girlfriend, right?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. I can't really speak for them. I know that like Matt was about to release a solo record. Duff was about to hit the road with Loaded. And Slash kind of had his thing going on. And that really was the thing that kind of refocused everybody. But you know what? I'm not going to sit here and take credit for it.
Of course.
Maybe they had a master plan and didn't let me in on it.
But yeah.
It seemed like that band getting together for that kind of brought everybody on the same page.
Yeah. Now, I remember, it's funny because I think Buck Cherry is really a little bit has to do with me moving to L.A. because, you know, for a long time, rock is kind of dead. As far as that kind of regular rock and roll, you know, because you guys are around in like 98 or something.
Yeah.
I remember I read a little square, I think it was in Rolling Stone. It said, this band's got a song about cocaine. They're called Sparrow, and there's this big buzz on them, and rock is back, you know? And I was like, what, Sparrow? First of all, I thought it was a great name, you know? And I was like, oh, I got to check this out. And I remember coming down and I was playing gigs at the Viper Room and shit. And I was like, this shit is alive. And San Fran had completely fucking died from the .com. The first wave of .com, it just blew. It was tumbleweeds.
Yeah.
And all my friends were married and had moved on. And I was single and still wanted to play rock. And I came down. I was like, this shit is alive. And I moved down here. But my point is, how do you start, like, I don't even know about you at all until you guys are up and running, you know? But were you in bands before? Are you from L.A.?
No, I'll tell you how it all starts. My dad got on top of my mom.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Fuck, yeah. You got any footage of that?
I got some Polaroids. I just Polaroids. How did it all start? I moved here in 90...
From where?
From a little town called Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania.
Wow. So you're like a rocker out there in bands before?
Yeah, it's very, you know, the only thing you could do back there was playing cover bands.
Oh, yeah.
You know, of course. And then we'd wait to the third set of the night. I have to say, being in a cover band, best thing that ever happened to me because I had to learn other people's music.
Yeah. And then you learn how to write from it and stuff.
Exactly.
And you also learn different chords and tunings and all kinds of flavor.
Exactly. So I was really lucky because for some reason in Western Pennsylvania, I was in a little, the guys in my high school that I was in this band with called Stone Mona, those guys were obsessed with writing songs. And they were obsessed with listening to records and talking about the parts and Vaughn, Scott, and Tony. And these guys, I felt like, when I look back now, like I didn't know what the fuck a pre-chorus was or a transition or a modulation. Yeah. I don't come from that school. I put the record on and like played to the record.
Yeah, you never understood why a chorus sounded different when it modulated.
Exactly.
Did it speed it up?
Yeah, the whole kind of, like I don't come from that school. And those guys were like so into it. And I just... That's the band I was in.
Yeah.
And I was the rhythm guitar player because I sucked.
Yeah.
And they were all the best guys. And
is high school?
This is like, they had been doing it for a long time. I had been a drummer. I switched to guitar when I was 18. So right over like my freshman, sophomore year of college, like I was coming back every weekend and just playing in this band. And
you went to college, huh?
I did go to college.
What'd you go to school for?
Criminology.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, man.
I'm not really using it right now. Yeah. but I did graduate, and that's a whole other story. Anyway, so I was lucky enough to be in a band with these guys that really took that seriously. And it was like an education from the... I still use the stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to those guys for that. So I moved to LA in 93. And I met Josh in 96.
Now, you moved to LA to play rock?
To chase the dream.
Right. Yes. Now you graduate from college, but you're like, fuck that.
I graduated from college with a 4-year degree in criminology pre-law.
Yeah.
And I thought that I was either going to pursue law school or be an investigator. Like, you know, like popping kids for like
Magnum PI shit.
Yeah. Just something interesting, you know, not like stopping people for fucking running red lights, but more like, you know, investigations kind of shit like that.
Zodiac killer shit, stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm obsessed with true crime.
Yeah, but still. Black Dahlia, all that stuff.
All of it. All of Green River, you name it.
Shit is just so insane, man.
So
there's one going on right now, the Long Island murders. There's like a serial killer, I guess, in Long Island right now.
Oh, really?
It's been a long time since there's been a serial killer. It seemed like, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 50, and it seemed like in the 70s, there was just a gallon of these fucking guys. You know what I mean? I mean, it was so scary to grow up in the 70s. I was like, I'm going to get snatched any day.
Exactly.
You had the Jim Jones fucking Guyana fucking incident. Yep. You had Patty Hearst in the SLA. You're coming off of Manson. You've got the Zodiac killer. You've got the fucking what's the New York one?
Berkowitz.
Spike Lee did the movie on him.
Yep.
What was that guy's name?
The fuck was his
God,
name?
That guy.
David Berkowitz, but they called him.
He had a name. They caught him. Remember, like a license plate or something.
Yeah.
That was a great movie.
All of that shit.
All that shit, man. There was some fucking loonies out there, man.
They're still there. They're just better disguised. And we're protecting our children better. Whole other conversation.
Yeah, I get it. But I'm just saying, I think also there was only four channels back then, TV. So it was just channel.
And it went off at... there's only one channel that ran all night.
Yeah.
It wasn't the local one. It was like the one on the UHF where it was like the other dial.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I always called that the cocaine channel because you'd come home like, oh God, I can't sleep. You're just looking at whatever's on. But anyway, you moved to LA in 93 and you say you're chasing the dream. What dream is going on at that time? Because we're at the end of course, GNR and all that. And now we're into Jane's Addiction. We're also into Pearl Jam.
Right.
And,
well, let me see.
Are you into grunge?
Not really. Because I was a country boy, the flannel shirts came naturally. And I thought it was really funny that these sissies were wearing flannel. Because from where I come from, they were just a bunch of wimpy, whiny Seattle sissies wearing my work boots and my flannel. When I actually wore those to work. Because what I should mention is I don't come from one of those families that said, go to college, we'll take care of it. They said, you better go to college because you're not going to amount to shit. We're not going to pay for it. But
yeah.
So I worked labor jobs. I dug holes. I did landscaping.
Had all those, the worst.
I did a lot of work as an arborist, which would be climbing trees. You know, it's a glorified way of saying like a tree guy.
Tree trimmer.
Yep. Started out on the ground, rolling the logs and raking up. And then eventually, because I did it for like 3 years, I do it all summer.
Yeah.
I do it on the weekends to make money. That's what I did. So I graduated from school and I went back and I did tree work for about 8 months for a whole summer into the winter and into the fall, and saved every penny.
Yep.
And moved to LA with kind of everything I had was in the back of an S10 pickup truck.
But what bands are driving you at the time?
Of the current bands, certainly the idea of Guns N' Roses is like...
So you're still spilling off the Sunset Strip dream.
I was never, and I don't mean that I don't like them. I was never into like Faster Pussycat and the whole LA scene. Like that didn't appeal to me, but the Black Crowes, I was obsessed with
fucking
the Black Crowes.
Great, right?
I was obsessed with the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. And
London Choir Boys, were you into that?
No. But Free was one of my all-time favorite. I would say that and people would go, who? And I'm like, kind of like Zeppelin, but different.
It's so weird how people don't know Free or Faces, but they listen to everything.
Listen to the Stones and Zeppelin. It's
I mean, the Faces, just the song Flying alone is like, okay, this is all if they only did that. And Fire and Water, I remember when I was younger, I signed a record deal with this guy, and he was like, he was from London. He's like, why even make a record? Fire and Water has been made. Exactly. And I was like, fuck this guy, you know what I mean? As he's signing my band, And then later on I realized, there's probably some serious weight to that, man. Yeah. I mean, that Fire and Water record is unbelievable. And Andy, the bass playing was just insane.
And they were like 15-year-old kids. It's crazy.
It's so crazy. When you watch that stuff live at the Isle of Wight, it's insane. It's so simple. It's like
he's got two microphones taped together for the left and the right side of the PA. That's crazy.
I love it, man. And it, anyway, so you're into some good shit. Yeah, Black Crowes, I was obsessed with.
So that's kind of what I'm into. And I get to LA, and I'm looking for, grunge is definitely happening, and it doesn't really wet my whistle.
Yeah. It's weird because it was some, I mean, you don't like it, but I really
liked it. It's not that I didn't like it.
Right.
I liked Nirvana, but I knew it was a little too simple for me. So to put it on, I loved it.
Yeah.
To play it, not my thing.
Yeah.
I like the early Pearl Jam stuff, but it's just like anything else. When it becomes this scene that becomes so big, I love that early Soundgarden stuff.
Oh, are you kidding me? Loud Love?
We made our first record with Terry Date because of Soundgarden.
God damn.
That's the shit that I was like, that's fucking radical.
Well, I said recently that that's our Sabbath, because when I hear the Loud Love record, or even the Flower or the Floppy EPs, it's so dark and fuck. They became a total different band, like Def Leppard, Like Def Leppard, the first two records are, people don't even know those records exist and they're masterpieces. That early Soundgarden is a total different band from Black Hole Sun and Spoon Man. It's Sabbath times 10. It's so dark.
I didn't mind the later stuff with those guys, and that's my phone barking. Hold on a second.
Who let the dogs out?
Amateur hour here.
I didn't mind it. No, I don't mind it either. I love it. I'm just saying a lot of people don't even know Soundgarden's early stuff, which is really crazy to me. When I find a band that I like, let's say early on I get turned on to Zeppelin from Black Dog, I immediately am going through the whole catalog. I don't just go, well, I like this one song. I want to go, wow, this is great. Yeah. But some people are just like, I'm cool with Spoon Man in my iPod,
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I think we share that as I'm not really a dabbler.
Yeah.
When I get into something, I really get the fuck into it. And so it probably started off innocently enough with being a drummer and sitting down trying to learn Seagull on the guitar. And one of the guys in the kids in the neighborhood said, oh, you like that? You should check out the other Bad Company record. And then once my uncle heard that, said, oh, you like Bad Company? You probably ought to hear Free. And that's kind of how the history lesson happens.
Yeah, I like
and
that.
And so not getting ahead of myself, but as a musician, as a guitar player, very early on, I was into the Stones.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, I was into John Mellencamp when it was
Scarecrow the record.
The early stuff. Scarecrow.
Scarecrow is incredible.
And Lonesome Jubilee is a fantastic fucking record.
That guy is fucking way underrated,
from
dude.
From the songs to the way those records sounds to that's great shit. I can't really speak to his later stuff,
yeah,
but that stuff is fucking awesome.
That guy's an outlaw.
And it's important shit for me. So hearing him say, we left the Rolling Stones in our record, made me go look at the Rolling Stones. And then hearing the Rolling Stones and reading interviews and having them talking about, well, who is this Robert Johnson guy?
Yeah.
And who is, Sonny Boy Williamson, and who is Elmore James and
Muddy Waters, all this stuff.
Finding all about all that stuff, yeah, led me down this road to like really getting into the blues. So as I was transitioning from being a guitar player, from a drummer at around the age of 17 to 18, right at the end of high school, and I got into guitar, I would see the really skinny guys with the pointy headstock guitars playing guitar, and I thought I couldn't identify with it.
Yeah.
But I could get down with like hearing some slide guitar and hearing that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where I instantly gravitated towards.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't think that I would love to put on Surfing with the Alien by Joe Satriani, because I can appreciate it.
Yeah.
And to me it's very listenable. But I can't play like that. That's just not my thing.
That never grabbed me, but Shanker UFO, God, yep, yeah. Exactly. Those were my guitar guys. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, Shanker to me is like one of the most insane players of all time. And the MSG group and UFO and all that, those are my guitar guys. Later on, the Shredder guys, I enjoy Yngwie because it's so loony, but all that after it, because to me, it's kind of Hendrix. Then you go Eddie Van Halen. A lot of people say Randy Rhoads, but I say Yngwie because it's so fucking, the sweet picking and all that. I was like, this is fake. It's got to be fake. It was so different, right. You know? So,
I'm going to go top five unsung heroes of the guitar. You ready?
Yeah.
In no particular order.
Okay.
Neil Schon.
Unbelievable, dude. Unbelievable. Not only that, but I remember when I was a kid, he had his own guitar, Schon, that Jackson made. Yep. And they're really rare. You can find them. And I wanted one so bad. They sold them at this shit rehearsal studio I rehearsed at. And I wanted a Schon bad. That guy is a god. And the Infinity record is unbelievable. I mean,
you could sing his solos. And that's okay. So Neil Schon.
Yep.
Joe Walsh.
Oh, come on, dude.
He doesn't get his due. Yeah. Paul Kossoff.
Oh, yeah, another just
I got room
God.
For two more. I can squeeze two more in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to go like Billy Gibbons.
Oh, God,
I just doesn't think he gets it. Like, he gets the accolades.
And Shanker.
There you go. There's our five.
There you go.
There you go.
I mean, these are never... Whenever you see the top 10, it's always the same dudes. It's Eddie. It's... Hendrix, of course, and then they'll throw in some fucking wild card, like, you know, and you're like, what? You know, and then Angus, Angus is definitely...
And then they'll throw in, like, your Danny Gatt and Roy Buchanan, because they kind of have to go, oh, we're clever.
I never got into Roy Buchanan's playing, and I tried a lot, but it was just so cluttery to me. It was I respect it, and it's crazy, but whenever I watch it, I go, whoa, man, you know?
Yeah.
He was going to replace Mick Taylor, which was crazy for a minute, you know? Yeah. Everybody was going to replace Mick Taylor, but Mick Taylor is another in the top five, I think.
And while we're on Mick's, Mick Ralphs.
Yeah, Mick Ralphs, man. I mean,
Mott the fucking Hoople, dude.
Yeah, Mott the Hoople, and just fucking, also songwriters.
Yeah.
These guys wrote crazy-ass songs. At the end of the day, who gives a fuck about guitar without the songs?
I just met Mick for the first time when we were in Europe last week. Couldn't have been nicer. Like, just swell.
Wow.
Just awesome. Yeah. Wanted to just talk about his grandkids, you know? Yeah. Just rad dude.
Also, later on, Mark Ford. I mean, that guy played the fuck out of those records, man.
He did.
You know, when you hear Mark, I played with Mark Ford, and when he plays, you just go like, wow, this guy is crushing. Yeah. Okay.
So
93, you're landing here. Where do you move to? Where do you live?
I land on Fuller.
Uh huh.
And I live as and then I eventually. Oh, I live in the Pinnacle, at the top, right at the bottom of Runyon Canyon.
Yeah.
I get a job at NRG doing movie surveys.
Wow.
Down on Hollywood Boulevard, up in one of those buildings, for like what? $4 an hour, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's brutal. It's brutal.
And you're cold calling people and asking them what they thought of movies?
Yeah, you got to keep them on the phone for like 20 minutes to do a whole survey with them.
Oh my God, and the worst.
One of those sweat box rooms filled with like loser musician guys like me.
Yeah.
This is with a college degree.
Yeah.
And then I somehow, there's a Pittsburgh connection that I know somebody, and I get hooked up with a job at Aardvark's Odd Ark, which was the clothing store at the corner of
Aardvark's.
Martell and Melrose. It's not called Aardvark's anymore.
Right, I know. Is that how you start learning about clothing?
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny. Yes,
because I had no idea about, you know, Pendleton's and Selvedge denim and
Biggie denim.
No idea.
Yeah, and Bucco's.
Yes.
And you know, Harley Davidson leather jackets, originals, all that.
I didn't know what horsehide was from anything. You know, it just didn't matter to me.
But you start learning there, and it spills into your whole life, right?
It really does.
It's like me, like, you know, Marco Segueda from Death Angel. He worked at Wasteland, and all my buddies worked at these stores on Haight Street, and then we had Leathers and Treasures in the 80s on Sunset on Melrose, and that guy taught me everything about leathers. I'm the Pope of Melrose, this guy. He's like, Bucco, that's the jacket you want. And I was like, this kind of shit is embedded in my fucking brain, you know?
Yeah.
And other guys are like nudie suits, and these guys are like, you know, that San Francisco musical, what's that company called? They made the leather pants for everyone. Something musical. And they actually called their clothing musical instruments. I forget now, and I know it like an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's some great shit. And then North Beach Leathers. Yep. You start learning all that
and
stuff.
And obviously Langlets.
Langlets, yep.
So that's kind of where I got the bug for clothes.
Yeah.
And then realizing as a guy that wasn't a very common size, like how hard it is to find. So like, that's why I'm always searching.
Your shoulders or what?
Yeah, because I'm over 6 foot tall and I am over 175 pounds. So, shoulders, legs, you know, I've spent a lot of time riding a bicycle and have the legs to show it. And like getting into a pair of vintage selvedge jeans, it's hard to find them. You can find them big enough to get up over your waist, but then they're like 6 inches too short because they're made for some fat guy.
Yeah, you got to go to fucking Selvedge, man. All their pants are 36 length.
Really?
They start at 36 length, dude. Every pair there. Look at this pair was 36 length when I bought it.
You know, I had good luck at that Rising Sun in Pasadena.
I only go to one store over there on La Brea Selvedge because it's just a one-stop shop.
Nice
flannels, pants.
I'll check it.
Oh, you're gonna.
But Rising Sun in Pasadena, great little spot down there.
Yeah,
and they make them all in house.
Oh, they make them.
And they'll tailor it for you so you can get them the length that you want them. Yeah. But it doesn't look like the cleaners did it. Like they're doing it in house.
Yeah, this same here, chain stitched, the whole fucking thing, man. You know,
because you know we're geeks about that.
We are. We're freaks.
I'd rather have two pair.
Yeah,
and wear the shit out of them than have like 50 pair and
you're right
and not have it be the right shit.
You're so right. It's like early on in my life I had a house full of mistakes.
Yeah,
there's nothing worse than like this looks good and then after 2 weeks you see a photo of you on stage or something, you go, God, that looks fucking horrible. I remember I had these silver leather pants. I was like, gonna be like Iggy Pop. And I look at them, they just looked like a fucking aluminum foil on me, man. And I thought for sure, this is it. I gotta have these. They were like fucking big money, you know? Thank God for eBay.
But I have to say, the style of anti-style, not so much anti-style, but keeping things really simple and classic.
Totally.
It's not easy. Because you have to, that stuff isn't readily available. People in middle America, wherever they shop, like you can't find that shit.
No, you've got, you can't.
Where I came from in Pennsylvania, that shit wasn't available at the mall.
And it really wasn't available until about 5 years ago, unless you went to Japan. Yeah. That was my whole dream. When I finally went to Japan with the Stones, you know, these guys, people were sleeping during the day. I was up at like 8:00. Combing every, they got like Shinjuku. I'm over there, and then I'm over in this neighborhood where every kind of store. You go in a store and it's like, oh, this is the Beatles store. It's not Beatles, but it's clothing like that they wore. And yes. You're like, what the fuck?
It's crazy.
Then you go in another one, it's 70s hippie store. And you're like, but it's all new shit, but it's exact. Like, look at these rings that Robert Plant wore and shit.
Exactly.
Japan to me was why I wanted to go all the time, because they had that shit and they had crazy bootlegs. Now it's finally with all these cool stores like Self Edge or whatever you're talking about, Rising Sun, there's finally you can get it here, but for years, man, you had to go over there.
I mean, there's lots of great jean stores. There's Imogene Willie's in Nashville. Have you been? That's a great spot. Like, they'll go to same kind of thing. You'll get the cut, alter them a little bit for you.
It's
a great place to get good selvedge denim.
So they're
out there.
So you're working at this place.
So I'm working there, and
you want to start a band,
and I'm starting to go do the music connection recycler thing, looking for bands. But I kind of had a very specific thing, you know. And I thought, well, I'm not a shredder, and I'm not like this monster over the top lead guitar playing personality. I considered myself more of a songwriter and just kind of a sound
kind of a Keith Richards.
And I'm already playing in open G tuning.
Right.
Which I figured, you know, had to be worth something to the right situation.
At that time, though, there was a lot of bands that like were hot that you were talking about. Like, we had Black Crowes, but we had like Blind Melon. We had this whole other kind of scene going on, you know, of bands that weren't just playing like grunge. That when you look at it now, you go, wow, these bands had giant hits too.
Yeah.
Tons of bands, even like Blues Traveler. And you had that Horde thing going on, the kind of hippie thing.
So I answered an ad. I've been answered ads. You know, I went on horrible auditions, like just being so fucking nervous. Like, I couldn't play. I'd get in a room and I couldn't play. And I would just beat myself up so badly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's tough, man. It was really tough. I mentally just fucked myself out of like any kind of chance of doing anything. But I finally landed on a band that was looking for an open G rhythm guitar player. I'm like, perfect.
It just said that? Open G guy?
Yeah.
What were they into? Black Crowes?
It was more like... it was kind of like it wasn't as kind of hippie as Black Crowes.
Right.
It wasn't as on the backbeat. It was more Runka Runka. It was more Georgia Satellites than Black Crowes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Which is fine with me because Rick Richards for president.
Okay? Yeah.
I love that guy. I love that band. So they were called the Little Generals, and Kenny and Terry were Toby were the main guys in that band. They had a bass player named Johnny who didn't like me.
Yeah.
I didn't like him, so it was fine.
That's how desperate bands were back then. Hate this guy, but we can't find another dude.
Yeah.
Right? It was weird.
So, and I remember all those guys to this day. And,
AKA the fat bass player.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I won't even go into all that. So I joined that band, and they're like, cool, we have a gig at the Whiskey on Tuesday. And I'm like, fuck, dude, I moved to LA. I'm here like fucking 6 months playing at the Whiskey, bro.
Yeah.
How cool am I? When I come to find out, it's the No Bozo Jam.
Oh, yeah.
It's three songs. And before I knew it, I'm standing on the sidewalk sweaty with like guys throwing my amp at me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that was it? Yeah, dude, see you later. And I'm like that sinking feeling of like, how do I carry my amp, my guitar, and the cabinet in the head? Because I've always been that guy. I'm not playing through the house rig. I'm playing through my shit.
Yeah.
Because I've always been into my sound.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't play through that fucking Mesa Boogies.
What was your shit at the time?
50 watt plexi.
Yeah.
You're too loud. It's 50 watt. Shut up.
Yeah.
You know?
Too loud. Yeah. It's rock.
So, yeah, like that. And then,
what guitar?
I had a 72 Tele Custom.
Oh, the Keith one?
Yeah, that was tuned to open G.
Blonde or black?
Black.
Yeah, only for me.
And I had a black Les Paul that I actually moved here with that the old bass player from my band back in Pennsylvania lent me the money to get, and I had to pay him back like $20 a week.
Some 70s heavy one?
No, it was a brand new, like 80s.
Oh, that's cool.
Like a 1988 standard.
Which would be vintage now.
Exactly. And I remember like being cracked out and selling that guitar and really wishing now that I could go find that thing.
Whoa, man, you got on some crack?
Oh, dude, I have I don't want to say too much about that.
We talk drugs on this big time.
But I'm a recovery guy. And,
crack though, huh?
Well, you know, if anything that could get me out of...
You're the first crack guy I've had on. That's why I'm asking.
But it wasn't exclusive to that.
I gotcha.
So,
but that's that era, man, you know?
Yeah, anything that could get me out of the moment,
Yeah.
Was something I was into.
When does that hit? Once you're in LA?
So that has started with, and I don't really want to make it about this.
Yeah.
But I'll give you this.
Yeah, yeah.
A life of drinking.
Yeah.
From as early as I could steal beer off my father to getting sober in 1995.
Wow. And so it starts with booze and then you move to LA.
And then, yes, and it kind of rides this way. At college, it was like a daily thing.
Yeah.
With alcohol for sure. And by the time.
Day drinking?
Early afternoon.
Wow.
As soon as I could get. Yeah. And then it wasn't like the flask in the bathroom guy,
but yeah,
like,
yeah.
Let's get the fuck out of here and go get some beers, bro.
Yeah.
You know? Until I got sober in 95, and I've been sober ever since.
Was that a rock and roll thing to you? Because to me, partying was rock and roll.
There
you know,
was,
rockers
was,
drank and did
was
drugs.
This very romantic notion of that all working, that whole chemistry experiment.
Totally.
Working,
totally.
Until it really doesn't work. It's really an empty promise.
Yeah.
I have nothing but respect for people that can drink and use drugs recreationally and not get all fucked up.
Yep.
I'm not one of those guys. I found out the hard way. I tried really hard to make it work for so long.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't really, really make it work. So
it's weird to be in rock when you're sober in a way of not music wise or anything, but after shows when people are like, dude, well,
early on it was tough, but
that's
now,
what I'm saying,
it's,
now it's now like, everybody's fucking like that.
But there was a while there, you know, like 96. I remember playing like our first shows stone cold sober, and
yeah.
It was fuck, man, it's a mind fuck, but
it
you
is.
Get used to it, and now it's like, yeah, you know what, every single show I've played in Buckcherry I've been sober for,
and you remember,
and I remember every single moment,
yeah,
or at least I was present for every moment.
Also, you start getting high on the emotions, like, god, that was a shit gig, or that was an amazing gig, where when you're buzzed or drunk, all the gigs are just like, oh, yeah, that was great. You don't even fucking, it's just no sensory, you know, no senses at all. So is that how you meet Josh, like in a program or something?
I met Josh through Kevin Quinn, who was our tattoo artist.
Yeah.
And
your tattoo artist, you mean?
Yeah,
you're getting tattooed in LA, and you said you're looking for a singer.
And I was getting tattooed. He's like, you know, Josh, because there was a bunch of guys hanging around Kevin's studio. There was some of the guys from Goldfinger, like Charlie from Goldfinger was hanging around. A guy named Johnny that was in a band. All the guys that were in Josh's last band.
Josh was in a band before Buckcherry.
Yeah, he was in a band called Slamhound in L.A.
Right, and they didn't get a deal.
I think they were on the precipice of it for a while.
Right.
Who else was around then? Like, that's where I met John Five.
Yeah. What shop was it?
It was right across from Guitar Center.
Yeah.
There was a, that,
like next to like,
it was above Mesa Boogie.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Like, yeah.
He had that little,
remember Guitars R Us, Albert's joint?
Yeah.
That was fun.
So, it was kind of like a hang out there, you know, like I worked at Guitar Center across the street at this point.
Oh, so after the fucking,
so during my lunch break, I just go over to a studio and I just hang out, and you know, I was a sober guy out of my mind and didn't know, you know, and,
you get sober in LA?
Yeah.
Like what? You going to AA?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's got to be pretty fucking weird. You're out here in LA. You don't know very many people, right? Now, what? You had to hit rock bottom to go, right?
Yeah. And the people that I do know at that point are partying.
Yeah.
So I couldn't hang out with all my friends because they're just like, oh, dude, shut up. Just have a bump. Let's go.
What was the rock bottom?
Just... you know, there's the dirt you want, you motherfucker.
I don't care about that. I'm just saying.
It's just, you know, not wanting to live and not wanting to die.
Yeah.
All at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That hopelessness is pretty real.
Well, the reason I ask is because Hollywood can get like that. You know, you can see the very, very, very dark holes of Hollywood because you come out here and you've got this dream. And you start seeing people, some people rising up, some people dropping down, and the emotions and everything, and you don't know anybody, you're from fucking Pennsylvania, and after a while you're like, man, this is fucking, this sucks.
It's strange, you know, it's really strange. It's been a really interesting ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, when you see guys stay in the game, you have to respect it. You have to, even if you don't like what they do.
Yeah.
You got to respect it because it is not fucking easy, man.
It is. It's fucking insane.
And the lineup of people waiting for you to fall.
Yeah.
So they can keep you there and hold you down. I mean, I know because we got the second wind and I watched it all happen. It's fucking a trip.
Yeah.
It's a trip.
Yeah. So you meet Josh at the tattoo shop. Now, Josh is really, other than Little Caesar, Ron, was the first guy that I really saw that had a full-blown fucking bodysuit, man. Yep. And so is that where he's getting all his work done?
That's
where
we're both getting tattooed there. And
so you meet him there and you say, hey, I'm looking to start a band?
I was just like, hey, he's like, I heard you're a guitar player. And I go, like, I heard you're a singer.
We're just both
dudes in our 20s, just uptight and newly sober and trying to figure it all out.
Yeah. And he was sober too, huh?
Yeah.
Did he fall off the wagon recently?
No, not to my knowledge.
Oh, I was just wondering.
No.
Okay.
His game is good, dude.
Okay.
yeah, where am I going with all this?
So you meet him?
So we like, he's like, okay, well, come over to my house and we'll, after work on Tuesday. We both had day jobs, you know?
Yeah.
And he had a little Elisa's SR-16 drum machine and he had like a Tascam 4-track set.
Yeah.
4-track.
That was the standard stuff then, man.
Yeah. And he had a fucking what did he have? A little like Fender Squire bullet amp. And I played him a few riffs. He's like, cool. So I would sit there in his bedroom and I would program the drums.
Yeah.
And I would record it into the 4-track. And then I would record we had like two books and like something else and we'd put a microphone. We didn't even have a mic stand. I'd put that in front of the amp and I'd record it like some music in there. And then I leave him one track for vocals and then he would sing vocals down and that's how we made our first demos.
Were you into his voice right away or were you just doing it because it was somebody to jam with?
I was definitely into his voice because early on I knew he'd come from a lot of punk.
Yeah.
And he had this thing that was so powerful and Steve Marriott like.
Yeah.
And I was just like, holy fuck. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting tone. Like lit up, you know, come on. You know, you're like, wow, it sounded original. It didn't sound exactly like anybody. It was a rock voice.
Yeah, definitely a rock voice. So one of the things that became really obvious to me is that I come from a classic rock blues background and he comes from a punk background. So somewhere in the middle was where the juice was, where we overlapped is where it was going to get good.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the secret to what we do is like, you know, he brings that punk indie thing to it. And, but we have other influences that overlap. Like we both love AC/DC. But I'm into like that fucking blues that no one wants to listen to. And he's into punk stuff that I never got into.
Right.
And he's got all that in his repertoire. We both love funk music. We both love Motown. Like we love that stuff.
Yeah,
we'll listen to
that
stuff all the time on the tour bus. He'll listen to Rage Against the Machine and Slipknot. Not my favorite shit.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
But then I'll listen to Tom Petty and he'll be like, hey, that guy can't sing. I'm like, dude. Yeah. This is gold.
Come
this
on,
is magic
man.
Here.
It's fucking 40 hit songs there.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, you know, don't get me started. We could do a whole podcast on Tom Petty.
Absolutely. Because, absolutely. So you guys start demoing. What's this? What year is this? Like 95, 6?
Maybe 96.
Yeah.
And my AA sponsor at the time was like, I have a friend that plays bass. You should meet him. And that's how we met our bass player.
Yeah. What was his name?
Jonathan.
Jonathan,
uh-huh.
and then you had a lead player. Who was that? Because
no,
I don't know.
Because so early on, I'm the only guitar player.
Okay, 4-piece. Who's the drummer?
And then Josh's buddy said, "I found this ad for this drummer. You should call him." And the drummer showed up.
Yeah.
And there you go. There's like a 4-piece band. And my bass player and Josh were really hustling the business side.
Yeah.
They had telephone gigs where they did telephone sales.
Yeah.
And so they were like hustling, getting us booked places. And
now, how do you guys pick this name? It's a great name.
So
Sparrow.
We had the name game where everyone sat down with legal pads.
Yeah.
And it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was really fucking horrible. But Josh in his apartment on Ogden between Santa Monica and Melrose had this old vintage concert poster of the Doors.
Yeah.
And it said the Doors. It was all psychedelic. And underneath it, it was the old Magic Carpet Ride. What's that? Steppenwolf?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That band, they were called The Sparrow before they were called Steppenwolf.
The Sparrow.
And we saw the word Sparrow on there and we're like, that's cool. Wow. Not The Sparrow, just Sparrow.
Yeah.
So we called the band Sparrow.
It's funny, for a while I forgot the name of the band. I was calling him Swallow.
That's you fine.
Know, which is a bird too, but also two yeah. meanings. I was like, oh, it's a great name, Swallow, man. And they're like, I haven't heard them. I'm in LA. I'm all, yeah, yeah, they're in Rolling Stone or whatever, yeah. but it was Sparrow, yeah.
So yeah, so that was it. So we started to play.
And what are on the demos? Do you got like At the Movies and Lit Up and that shit?
We have
on
Lit
there?
Up.
Yeah, you had Lit Up.
We don't have For the Movies. For the Movies actually came.
Two sober guys singing about cocaine. Hilarious.
You know? That's an interesting point you bring up.
Yeah.
And if I didn't know Josh and know his experience, know what I know of his experience,
yeah,
and know how real that was for him, I would think it was bullshit, but it's not, because that dude is really telling a story.
Yeah.
It's not an advertisement for it. I think it's a cautionary tale if you really listen to the song.
Right.
And he lived it. So I think he gets to tell that story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I do a lot of bits about coke, and I say coke gets a bad rap, and then as a comedian, you know, and they people laugh at that because, you know, I think everybody in the room has had a great night on cocaine. The only thing we ever hear is the bad thing about, hey, you hear about Keith? Oh, he OD'd on blow. Yeah. You never hear about the 600 times before he OD'd where 400 of them were probably great times. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just, it's the person that fucking loses, you know, yeah, to the drug. Yeah. So,
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I went out last night and did a bunch of blow, and I leaped over a tall building, and I got the hottest chick in the club, and we went home, and it was amazing. And she's really into me for my personality and really gets me.
Yeah.
And I made it to work on time. I don't know. That just doesn't fucking happen.
No. So you guys got this and you start playing like some gigs, and how fast does the buzz come on?
I mean, it comes on kind of early because
there's nothing really going on in town at that time,
right? The thing about LA is you don't really get a chance to make at the time.
Yeah.
There was this void. Lilith Fair was big.
Yeah,
grunge was already established. It wasn't emerging. It was already a thing.
Of course.
And
it's the tail end of grunge, really, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of like dudes with shaved heads and long goatees tuning down. Korn's about to happen.
Right.
When we were playing in clubs, it was us and it was that band from Calabasas. What were the Incubus?
Oh yeah.
And it was
what about Cher's son? His band? They around?
No, wait, I'm thinking of the other band, System of a Down.
Oh, so they're
those
great,
were the three bands in LA that were kind of.
And that really describes the 90s. Buck Cherry, System of the Down, and Incubus. As far as like how, if like I shit on the 90s a lot, and then one day I Googled 100 songs of the 90s, and I was like, fuck, the 90s were great, man. And yeah. It was so, so different. Like all kinds of bands were flourishing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you got like Systems and all that, and then you got like Scott's band, you know? Fucking, what were they called? Scott Weiland's band,
STP.
STP, you know, yeah. All these different kind of rock forms of rock, you know, yeah. But they weren't like rock, you know. It was like, yeah, we're alternative rock. K Rock was playing all kinds yeah. of, yeah.
So, yeah, it was definitely an interesting time, and we so we started playing like local showcase. Like we went out and did a gig, and then somebody early on was like got us into. People around us, the people at ASCAP came around and like were trying to help us point us in the direction of like attorneys and managers and stuff like that. And basically we met this attorney and he said, stop playing shows.
Really?
Don't play a show until I tell you. And when someone from a record label comes up to you and talks to you, don't act like you want a record deal.
Yeah.
Just take their business card and tell them to call me.
Wow.
I'm like, okay.
He had a full game plan. What was his name?
Alan Mintz. He passed away a few years ago.
Wow. Okay. So he was smart.
He worked at a record label. I think he ran a label for a while.
Well, I've had A&R people on, and they said any band that wanted a deal, they hated them.
Yeah.
Like, ah, fuck these guys. But the bands that put the middle finger up and stuff, like, we don't give a fuck about you. They were like, God, I gotta have this band. It was almost that fucking gross boyfriend, girlfriend yeah. thing, you know?
So, that's kind of what we did. We'd go play a show. I remember they were events. I can remember being an unsigned band, playing the Viper Room. It's sold out. People are singing our songs. We don't have a record deal.
Wow.
And it wasn't like we were around that long. Like, we were around, we weren't put together by anybody other than ourselves.
Yeah.
It was just an idea that started.
And you put, you handing out demos and stuff to people?
Yeah.
Like selling demos and stuff?
Made a couple demos with Chris Johnson and then went and...
Bruce Bure, he does...
And we did stuff with Bruce too.
Yeah. Because Bruce is a good friend of mine. He's the guy that's like...
I love that guy.
He's telling me early on, we got the same birthday. We've known each other 30 years. He goes, yeah, I'm working on this band. They got a great song at the movies and another one lit up. You're going to love it. And I was like, oh, this shit is great, man. Who is this band, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess his stuff made the record, right?
Interesting, one song, and I'll tell you how that happened.
Yeah, okay.
So we're working with this attorney, and then we had a very hyped record deal. But it was really all smoke and mirrors, because at the end of the day, we actually only got one offer. But he created this scenario where it's like, everyone's submitting offers. They're all bidding. You better, you know. And DreamWorks came in with the checkbook. Bam.
Boom. What kind of deal is it? Like $1 million?
I didn't understand how a record deal worked.
Yeah.
The band's advance, just for us to have, wasn't that big. It was like $250,000.
Right. But fucking.
That's a two record fucking deal all in.
Oh yeah, that's all in. So do you immediately middle finger Guitar Center and walk?
No, after we got that money, I went back to the label and I said, okay, but you need to give us a fund for gear as well.
Yeah.
You need to give us another 50 grand so we can go buy gear.
Yeah.
Like because I knew how the game worked.
Yeah.
What about the advance? Well, like that's my, you know.
Living money.
Yeah, I need stuff to work. I need shit to work.
Yeah, yeah.
I busted the guitars. We need a new drum kit, motherfucker.
And a van.
So,
Who signed you over there? What's his name?
Michael Goldstone. But he's not who found us. The guy that found us is a guy named Jeff Sosnow.
Wow. He's like is he like an intern there?
He is Michael Goldstone's assistant. And he's the guy that finds us and tells Goldie, you got to see this band. And he's like, meh, whatever. And then he's like, no, you. And then a week later, you really got to see this band. And then a month later, it's like, dude, you got to go fucking see this band.
Yeah.
And so he finally comes and sees us.
And this is kind of like the tail end of A&R guys, you know, going out to clubs and signing bands. But this is pre-MySpace, where now they were just signing bands in the 2000s off MySpace. Like, they got 2 million people, sign them, you know, without even going to see them. So this is kind of like old school. You had A&R people there when they were really passing on you, but your guy made it look like everybody's putting offers in.
It's not that they weren't passing. They were just like, everyone's waiting for someone to fucking
jump
first.
And they don't
understand
rock at the time, right?
And they're like, and it was a gamble.
Yeah.
Because that was it was not hip, dude.
No.
It was not hip.
Fuck no.
But you had to kind of feel it in your gut. And
it really wasn't hip, because when you read Rolling Stone, they make it like, holy shit, the Strip is back. You know what I mean?
And we never thought of it like that. As a matter of fact, we weren't a Strip band.
Yeah.
So it's been funny through our career that we've been like, oh, they're LA, they're Strip rock, sleaze rockers. It's like, we didn't think of it like that. We're a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
You know, in the face of rap rock, in the face of the proliferation of this really bad fucking rock that they're calling active rock now, which is just
active
fucking
rock.
Horrid.
Active rock. I've never even heard that.
Yeah, it's.
I'd be so mad if they called me active rock.
We've always just been a rock and roll band.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? And it's a blessing and a curse at this point. It's a blessing in that when it comes on, you know exactly who the fuck it is.
Yeah.
And the curse is that when they're putting these festivals together all these bands sound alike, we're like, where's the love?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we've been really on our own island, forging our own destiny.
Yeah. So you get the record deal. You got the record.
Yeah.
And where do you do the record and who does it?
We do it at...
Terry Date does the first one?
Terry Date does the first one. We do it at NRG. And Korn's working on Follow the Leader next door.
Wow.
While we're doing it.
Yeah, you got Ross Robinson over there.
Yeah, I didn't really see those guys much.
Right.
So we do the record. And then we add another guitar player for the road.
Who is that?
A guy named Yogi.
Oh, yeah, Yogi.
So he fills out the sound.
Yeah.
And we go and we hit the road. We pound it.
Yeah.
And we get a gold record.
Yeah. And who are you out opening for?
Everybody. Lenny Kravitz.
Killer.
Fuel. Kid Rock.
Who are some of the worst guys and who are the best? Like Lenny Kravitz, that's a great tour for you guys, right?
Yeah. I mean, It's odd. The guys on the road that we've had the most issues with are usually guys of a similar age range.
Oh.
But the older bands, always awesome.
Yeah.
Always like, you know, the guys in Kiss taking the time to talk to us and, you know, give us advice.
I opened for Joe Walsh, dude. The guy was a god.
Yeah. The guys in AC/DC, just so rad.
Wow.
The guys
in Def Leppard.
Yeah. The guys in Def Leppard.
Wow. You opened for them too.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, Joe and Phil came to a show at the Whiskey before we even ever went on the road.
That's incredible.
And they were just so fucking rad. But like, then, you know, we toured with Monster Magnet and Phil is a friend.
Yeah.
And I dig Phil.
Yeah.
But like the rest of the guys in the band were kind of fucking jerks. And it's like, why is it that guys that we're like co-headlining with, like, why does it have to be weird? Yeah, when we're all out here together.
Yeah, it's not a competition,
it's
man.
It's so now. We've never viewed it as that, yeah. ever.
It should be us against the fucking business, not us yes. against us. That's what the business wants. They just want, let the sharks eat each other, man, and we'll just pick up the money. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, I have a lot of philosophies after 20 some years of being in this washing machine dryer cycle of,
yeah.
You know, most of the bands are really awesome, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get, so to me, the first record's good. I really like the second record, man. You know, Riding, I thought was like, it was so fucking, the video was cool. And first of all, I think At the Movies is the best song you guys did off the first record ever. But
so we finished our record,
yeah.
with the band, with who the label wanted us to make our record with, and went through that process. And we went back in the workaholic style that we have and started just writing songs before we went out and like played shows. And we wrote for the movies,
yeah.
and we wrote a song called, I think we wrote Riding
at
the
man.
Same time.
Wow.
And then we said, well, let's go record for the movies. Let's go back into Bruce's because we had a little bit of money in our pocket.
Yep.
Let's go back to Bruce's in 3 days and just record it. So we went over to Bruce's and we recorded it with Bruce.
Yeah.
And then we were like, fuck, this is good.
Yeah, it is.
Should we play it for the... We shouldn't play it for the label. We played it for the label.
Uh-huh.
Finally, begrudgingly. And they stopped the presses, stopped yeah. printing the record.
Whoa.
We're adding this to the record.
Wow. And thank God, right?
Yeah, and then we sent it to some guy in Nashville to mix it. I forget. It's probably on the back of the record.
Yeah.
And I usually know all those details. Anyway, he mixed it, and it ended up on the record.
What a great song. Now
we ran out of tracks, so the harmony guitar solo that I played was actually bounced down to one track.
Oh, fuck.
I couldn't split them.
Oh.
So it was either there or it wasn't.
So you go to do the second record, and this is kind of where the wheels fall off, right? The record comes out, and...
The record comes out. The making of that record, we fired our manager during the making of that record because we didn't really feel like he was an advocate for the band.
Right.
We felt like he was an advocate for the record label.
Oh.
And we were very much not about being told what to do.
Yep.
We fired the manager. Put a new manager in place, finish the record. Our manager does a very successful job of giving the Heisman to the record label while we're making the record.
Wow.
And then when
the
we
new
finish,
manager?
Yes.
Wow.
Which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
Till we need the label to actually help us promote the record. And then they're like, yeah, we really weren't involved in this record. Sorry. We'll put it out, but we're not going to.
Wow.
So we were naive enough to think, fuck you, we're going to go out and tour for, you know, 18 months and we'll make this record one gig at a time.
Yeah.
Well, no one knew the record was out.
Yeah, and, it's crazy.
And it died on the vine.
And there
while
you are.
While it's dying on the vine,
yeah.
the band's starting to implode.
Yeah.
And so by the time we get home from that tour, everyone has quit the band except Josh and I.
Right. It's just over
I'm sure they have
friction,
their,
right?
I'm sure they have their versions and their stories and they're entitled to all of that. What I know is that everyone quit the band.
Yeah.
And we still wanted to keep doing it. No one was fired. Everyone had quit. So that's when Josh and I went into the label. The guy that signed us there was no longer there.
Of course.
And
that old story.
Yeah. And Michael Austin was still there. And we went to write him. He was he's basically running the show. And we went into his office and said, this is what we want to do. We want to keep writing songs and we want to make this happen. And we still want to be here. And he's like, if you guys still want to do this, I'll still put your records out. He was rad.
Wow.
He was one of the last holdovers of the old business. You know, his dad was Mo Austin.
Yeah.
And
that's crazy
kinda,
that
they
he
kind of invented artist development, which doesn't fucking exist anymore.
He was behind you, but they fucking clowned you on the second release because that record's good.
But I don't think they were aware of it.
Right.
Because
oh, the higher ups, you mean?
Because the guy that actually signed us had become a higher up. So he could kind of insulate that, I think.
Wow.
I don't want to accuse anybody of doing anything devious, but the proof is in the fact that we did one video for the record.
Yep, right.
We did one photo shoot.
Yeah.
And it was, and then couldn't get a return phone call.
Insane. And how fast do you guys come off the road? Because your tour support has to just dry up instantly, right? You're out there.
Well, at that point, they wouldn't give us tour support to go to Europe.
Yeah.
And
you're coming off a fucking gold record, right, man.
So they wouldn't give us tour support to go to Europe. And then the tours in the States are actually generating a little bit of income.
Yeah.
So we're breaking even. So we don't need them for tour support in the States because we're actually in the black. I'm only making $1,200 a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at least we're in it's not costing us money.
I mean, when I saw you guys, it was done. And that was in San Fran at the Pound.
That was right at the end.
That was right at the end. And I remember showing up and there was no one there.
It was September 12th. That's why.
Yeah.
They just blown the World Trade Centers up the day
before. Wow. It was the day after that.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember. And I remember Tony Caracci owned the place, a guy who was like, I'm opening a rock club. And it was at an old place that was an actual dog pound out in the middle of San Fran in this weird area that no one ever went to. I was like, what is this joint? You guys put up in a tour bus. There's no one there. And I was like, ah, fuck, man. This record's great. There's no one here, you know? And then it was over, it seemed like, you know? But you guys, after they all quit, you take a break or, you know, because...
Well, no, right after they quit, like, we're like, we got to get another record together. We got to write these songs and get a band together.
Yeah.
So we start writing songs. That's when Crazy Bitch is written.
Gotcha.
And then shortly thereafter... like I met Slash at a NAMM show, and I think and by that spring summer is when we all had gotten together.
Yeah, and then that doesn't work. And is the label at the time when the Velvet Revolver thing it doesn't work or whatever? Is the label going, hey, where's the record at or whatever?
No, I think they were kind of like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah,
you know, it's not like they hadn't given us like this huge advance or anything. They were giving us a small stipend to kind of ease the pain.
Yeah.
But by this point I have a kid.
Yeah.
And just trying to make it all happen. And so the Velvet Revolver thing disintegrates. And I'm like, well, what the fuck do I do? Josh wants to go make a solo record and kind of do his own thing. And I'm like, okay. So then I just got to figure it out, dude.
Yeah.
I don't have really a safety net. There's not anybody go, oh, it's cool. There's no safety net.
And so then you start looking at country a little bit, which is hot at the time, like Jamie Johnson. There's like Lucinda Williams, that kind of alt country and stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
I was just, you know, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I was so tired of being in a band and so tired of dealing with people and so tired of dealing with attitudes and all the bullshit and just dishonest motherfuckers and just guys that just were shitty humans.
Yeah.
But you somehow end up in some sort of situation with them. Not all of them. I don't want to say that, but like there's enough of them sprinkled throughout.
I get
it. To piss in the fucking Kool-Aid, you know?
Yeah.
This guy that I've known since I got to Hollywood, this guy named Johnny Kaplan called me up and he's like,
oh, hey, Johnny Kaplan.
Yeah. Hey man, how you feel about, I need a rock star guitar player in my band. And I was just like, I'll come play guitar with your band, dude. it's country. Yeah. I don't have to think about anything. I show up and play the songs.
Yeah.
You know? I'd start.
Was that Lazy Stars?
Yes. And I started hustling work.
He had a buzz for a while, man.
He did. And we got a drummer in there. When I started playing with him, Mitch Marine was playing drums. Mitch has left that and went and played with Dwight and has been with Dwight ever since.
Yeah.
I just saw Mitch a couple months ago. He's doing great. Loving life. He had a bass player named Dave, and Johnny didn't like Dave, but like whatever. What ended up happening was we got this drummer in there named I called him the Fish, Doug Goodstein, and we needed a bass player. And I ran into Jimmy Ashurst and Rick Richards from the Satellites.
Yeah.
One night out at some club, and Jimmy had just gotten out of the joint.
Yeah.
He was fresh out.
Wow.
And I love Rick. You know, Rick's one of my all-time favorite guitar players. He's one of my heroes. And I said to Johnny that night, that's the guy you need to have. We need to have playing bass in this band, Jimmy Ashurst.
Yeah.
He's like, well, you know, he's trouble. He's been in prison. I'm like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I'll keep an eye on him.
Yeah.
Let's fucking get that dude. And so I like called Jimmy up and he doesn't even have a bass. And so I go take him a guitar and I was like, you need to be writing songs. I give him one of my guitars and I call him, start calling him up to play on demos of stuff that I'm working on.
Yeah.
And so Jimmy joins the band and we got this drummer that plays like Charlie Watts. And I start listening to this guy's songs and I'm just like, I'm going to tune in open G for this one.
Yeah.
And so it starts to take on like, Johnny's band at the time started to sound to me like
Dead Flower stuff.
Kind of like what Graham Parsons may have sounded like if he was in the Stones.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
And
like look, that exile, pre-exile shit.
He's not Graham and I'm not that Keith. So I would never equate that, yeah. But it just kind of like, it was a very rock and rolly country thing.
Right.
Which
right.
I liked.
Yeah. Burrito Brothers, you and the Burrito Brothers, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, and that was fun. We did that for a number of months. And then I realized that it wasn't a situation that I wanted to pursue. I'm going to not character assassinate, but I didn't really want to pursue that any further.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess at this point, I'm working with a couple of singer-songwriters. I'm working in studios and I'm hustling, trying to, you know, make money. I got a kid. I got to pay my rent.
Yeah, when I met you, man, you had a killer fucking house. And then you sold that house in Laurel Canyon recently. I was like, this guy made money. So, like, did you make money from Buck Cherry?
Well, hang on. So, back up. When you met me.
Yeah. Studio City here?
I was in Studio City. This is back before that. The first wave of the band, prior to that, I didn't make any money.
Right.
Other than, like, a couple of advances. There really wasn't, like, any money to be made. So, I'm just kind of hustling. And at some point in there, couple years later, I'm working on stuff. I called Jimmy up to keep playing on my demos and stuff. Great bass player. And Josh and I decided we're going to try and maybe saddle this horse up again.
Yeah.
And when I do, I'm like, I got the bass player, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
I got the guy. And so the band restarts. And Jimmy's the bass player and Josh is the singer, obviously. And Xavier, I knew from way back in the day when I first moved to LA and we actually worked at Guitar Center together.
Yeah.
And Stevie was a friend of Josh's who was actually became a friend of mine. And when the band was on hiatus was kind of like a secret go-between the two of us because he was friends with Josh and he was friends with me and he'd show up at my house and he'd go, you know, Josh has asked about you.
Oh.
I'm like, yeah, well, tell him I said, what's up?
You and Josh had some friction for a while?
Well, not a friction. I think we both needed a break. And neither one was willing to pick up the phone, but I don't think it was like a fuck you kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, so Crazy Bitch, it catches fire. Does that make you some big money, Crazy Bitch?
We did really well with Crazy Bitch.
Because it was everywhere.
So as far as the money, I mean, that's a pretty fucking cheesy question to fucking ask your people on your show.
Well,
you motherfucker.
The reason I asked was, and it's not, you don't have to give me any numbers or anything, but why I ask is I think there's always an illusion that people, he had a record deal, he had millions, man. And then,
okay,
you know,
let me debunk a few things.
Totally.
The early on, the $1 million record deal that we got, it was worth over $1 million, but that doesn't mean the band puts $1 million in its pocket.
Right.
That means that all in, the band gets to spend $1 million on videos, on tour support, on advertising, on radio promotion, on everything that goes into it. But the band doesn't put $1 million into their pocket.
No, and it's $1 million loan.
It's $1 million high motherfucking interest loan.
Yeah.
So for every penny, any dollar that you earn, you're paying back 14 cents on a dollar until you've paid it back. Then you start to get paid.
Yeah.
It's fucked accounting. And whoever invented it really didn't give a fuck about the artist.
So
it is changing, thankfully. Yeah.
To actually make money on Crazy Bitch, it really
okay,
did
so
well.
The reason that Crazy Bitch made money is because A, it was released on an independent record.
Oh, right. So Austin cuts you guys loose eventually. DGC.
Well, okay, so what happens is they have the band, you know, Josh and I decide to go separate ways. They have the first right of refusal on whatever happens next. So Josh does a solo record and they pass.
Right.
Okay. So we're done with our deal.
So they just say, okay, because he turned in a solo record. Doesn't have anything to do with Buck Cherry. So, but still they go, we're done.
Right. And then whatever worked, the it had lapsed.
Gotcha.
We were done.
So then you demo up and start doing this
So then we make, I'll give you the short version of this. We make, because I have to get on a plane and go.
Okay, cool. But you sign an indie deal.
No. We make demos.
Uh-huh.
We shop them all around. No one's interested. We shop them to Japan. Japan bites. Japan writes us a check for $100,000.
Yeah.
And we're lucky enough to get it as a licensing deal, which means they're going to pay us $100,000 for the right to license the record in Japan.
Wow, that's good.
But we still retain the ownership of the master, so we own it. So instead of paying ourselves, we use that money. We all take a little piece because we all needed some bread.
Yep.
We use that money to quickly make the 15 record. We make it in 15 days. We own the masters.
Where do you make it? At your studio?
We make it. No, I didn't have a studio yet. I didn't have a house yet. I was still a renter.
Wow. You peasant.
I know.
like me right here. It's the renter.
So we take the finished record, shop the finished record.
Yeah.
And everyone passes on it, which to me was like, wow. Okay. So then our manager at the time said, I'll make a record label. We'll put this fucking record up.
Yeah.
And we had to get really creative because there wasn't a lot of money. So we got really creative with how we were going to put the record out and how we were going to market it. And one of the things we did was there wasn't really a Facebook yet. So yep. We used MySpace.
MySpace.
And we put up 3 songs on MySpace. And one of the ones that we put up was Crazy Bitch.
Right.
And it went from like 1,500 listens to 1,000,000 to like 2 million listens.
What?
Like, bang, bang, bang. We're like, what the fuck?
Wow. And
then the fucking station in Baltimore, WIYY.
Yeah, yeah.
Takes the song off of our MP3 player, rips an MP3 off of it, puts duck quacks over the fucks.
Uh-huh.
Plays it on the air. Phones blow up. Song starts taking off.
Wow.
We weren't even gonna release it as a single.
Of course not, because it's got all the swearing in it.
It's got fucking bitch all over it. Like, we're just never gonna play that. and it starts taking off.
Yeah.
There you have it.
Fucking great, dude. And then you've been playing ever since. You guys put out that fuck EP, and then you did.
We did that record. We did the Black Butterfly record. We did the All Night Long record. We did the Confessions record.
All on your manager's label?
No,
Crazy Bitch got your record.
At one
deal?
Point, we got upstreamed to Atlantic, and then we were downstreamed again, and then we had a falling out with that manager. We fired him, so clearly we weren't going to be making records for him anymore.
Right.
And ultimately, 2 records ago, we started our own record label, and that's where we live right now.
That's badass. Now, I know you got to go, so where are you going?
I'm going to go to Vancouver, eh?
Yeah, and do gigs?
Anytime you say a city's name in Canada, you got to say A at the end.
And you're going to do...
shows, eh?
You guys are out, eh? Are you guys out on tour right now?
When you get up to Vancouver, make sure you go to Dayton Boots.
Oh, I will.
Have them make you a custom pair of boots.
Oh, man, I'm fucking booted up. West Co., Whites, fucking... Okay. Brian the Bootmaker's my guy now.
You got to go by.
All right. I love it. Will you come back again? We'll talk guitars and clothes.
Yeah.
Because I want to get into the Zomaida stuff.
Okay. Yeah. We should talk about that.
Yeah. So why don't we do a part 2 in a couple weeks?
All right. I'm going to go to Vancouver. We're going to hightail it from Vancouver east through Canada.
Yeah.
A couple U.S. shows. We're going to wind down. We finish up the tour the night before Thanksgiving in Sayreville, New Jersey at the wonderful Starland Ballroom.
Yeah.
And then we're coming home to have some holidays with the family, which is much needed at this point.
And then let's do part 2.
You got it, buddy.
Thanks, buddy.
You got it.
And where can people find you? Instagram?
They can find me at TheRealKFN on Twitter.
Yep.
I don't do the Insta, but all the other guys in the band do.
Get on it.
Nah, I'm just not down.
All right, buddy.
And then, of course, all things Buck Cherry at BuckCherryWorldwide.com. And Buck Cherry has a Twitter as well.
Nice. Thank you, dude.
Thanks,
and
buddy.
I'll see. We'll do a part 2 and we'll talk those Zomaida guitars and leather jackets.
Party on, Wayne.
Thank you, brother. See ya.